Greetings, listeners. Welcome back to Peace Bound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast brought to you by the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Now, on this show, we discuss stellar runs of Wonder Woman, beginning with the best run of all time, the George Perez written and drawn issues of Wonder Woman from his monumental reinvention of the character in 1987. On each episode, we will have a special guest from the larger podcasting community to help me dive into the issue. Today's guest is a comic book crusader who loves Spider-Man, X-Men, New Warriors, 12 Days of Christmas. Please welcome from the Long Box Crusade podcast, Jared Albrecht. Jared, how you doing?
What's up, man? Listing all my favorite things, man, plus all kinds of other stuff too. But yeah, man, I'm happy to be here on Themyscira, or however it's pronounced.
No, that's right, yeah.
Okay.
Well, I'm glad to have you. I'm super excited. Now, we've had a chance. It's been a while, but we have recorded together quite a few times, actually. I've been on Longbox Crusade. I was on a 12 Days of Crusademas. Mm-hmm. You know, I've helped Clinton try to escape the basement on Fan Films Fridays. So it's exciting to record with you. And I know it's summer. You know, this episode will be released in May, but I'm sure you guys are chipping away at those Crusademas episodes, which are just beloved. I mean, I'm sure you get good feedback on them, but I have to tell you, it is literally one of my favorite holiday traditions.
Awesome, man. That was our whole goal when we started it way back in, I think it was like 2017, give listeners something to listen to every day, counting down to Christmas Day from 12 days out. So yeah, that was our goal, and I'm glad you enjoy it.
I do, which is especially funny because I'm Jewish. So no one loves Christmas traditions.
I remember that.
Yeah. No one loves Christmas traditions more than a Jew, man. I am super happy when Christmas music starts during the year. I love when Crusademas starts. I love Hallmark movies. It's a weird thing, but no one loves a fun Christmas tradition like a Jewish guy.
I'm happy to give you that, man. I can't wait till you start your comic book countdown. I guess as we light the menorah, you know, I'll be on one with you. Sure.
There we go. I'll do the 8 days of Hanukkah.
And, yes.
And I'll tell you, it lines up perfectly. And I'll tell you what I told my wife the first time, our first Hanukkah together, I was like, I don't have to get you 8 gifts, right? And she's like, yeah. She's like, it's a gift for each night. I'm like, well, I'm just going to go buy an 8-piece bucket of chicken and you'll get a piece each night. There you go.
Yes. See, you're doing it right. Exactly.
Before we begin, the Fire and Water Podcast Network brings hours of amazing content to the airwaves each month, and we needed some help running the network and hosting our shows. So we started a Patreon. At certain tiers of support, you can sponsor a show, and I'd like to thank Martin Gray, Darren Appel, and Brett Young for choosing to sponsor Peace Bound and Down. If you're interested in joining our Patreon, please visit patreon.com/fireandwaterpodcastnetwork.com. So, Jared, I'm going to ask you the question I ask every guest on every episode, and I'm always curious, especially given your background, having grown up in other parts of the world and being child of parents who in the military, how did you discover Wonder Woman? When did you first discover the character?
Man, I actually discovered Wonder Woman before my father got in the Army the second time. My dad was in the Army before I was born, right? And mm-hmm. then he had my older brother, Jason the Weasel Skull. And then 5 years later comes me. And dad had gotten out. He was an air traffic controller, civilian air traffic controller. And then he got back in because there was a big hullabaloo with air traffic controllers back in the 80s. So he got back in.
I remember, yeah.
Right. So I actually discovered Wonder Woman in that in-between times when we were living in Indiana. And I did it probably the way a lot of folks do it. Linda Carter?
Oh, yeah.
That's kind of how I did it. Now, I guess if I'm being honest, I probably knew her more from Super Friends first, but Linda Carter in the TV show, which this would have been circa 1981-ish. I would have been about 5. So mm-hmm. they would have been repeats because that show was on in the late 70s.
77, yeah.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I would have been catching these on repeats. And be honest with you, man, at 5 years old, seeing Linda Carter as Wonder Woman was amazing.
Yeah.
I remember reading an interview by a guy who would start writing Wonder Woman much later than we're about to talk about, Phil Jimenez.
Mm-hmm.
And if I remember correctly, Phil Jimenez is gay.
Yes.
And I think I remember in the interview, he said when he saw Wonder Woman on TV, Linda Carter was one of the moments he realized he was gay. It's a true story. I'm not making this up. But no, I'm thinking,
fascinating. Yeah, usually it's the opposite for most.
I'm thinking it was the exact opposite. Yeah. For me. At 5 years old, I was like, I like this.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
This is something I appreciate. And then funny now is when I go back as an adult and I look at it at Linda Carter. She's just one of the most beautiful women that ever lived.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Stunning. Yeah. Stunning. So yeah, that's how I found the gorgeous Linda Carter on television. Really. Yeah.
That's so funny about Phil Jimenez, because he draws, yes. He's one of my favorite artists and writers in comics, and he draws a beautiful, I mean, right on par with Perez, a beautiful Wonder Woman.
Oh, he's great.
It's funny. So yeah, I know my, Linda Carter was definitely part of my, you know, before I had words for it, awakening. I think Erin Gray was the other, but between Silver Spoons and Buck Rogers, there was definitely an Erin Gray moment in there.
My other one was Nichelle Nichols, by the way. I guess I was all about repeats of television shows.
There you go.
When I saw Lieutenant Uhura, I was like, I also like that.
I want to be in science fiction, man. I want to, yes. I want to be in space.
The lovely ladies of television.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah. I mean, just, yeah. And Linda Carter's still one of the most beautiful women in the world. I mean, just
great.
Unbelievable. Well, today we are jumping into Wonder Woman Volume 2, Issue 18, which is titled Creatures of the Dark, and it was released in July of 88. Is a script and layouts by George Perez, finish art by legendary Dick Giordano, letters by John Costanza, colors by Carl Gafford, and edited by Karen Berger. So, Jared, to jump into the show, before we talk about the issue itself, I like to open every episode with a silly little segment we call the Lasso of Truth, where the guest and I each grab Diana's golden lasso and tell one, any kind of truth, fun, silly, serious truth about ourselves. Now, since you're the guest, why don't you go first?
I guess this will be the second truth I tell, because I've told you about my young sexual awakening thanks to Linda Carter and Nichelle Nichols, but I actually did prepare on this one. I thought, what's a weird thing about me? And I guess a few people know about this because I have done a long box live stream opening a box of VHS tapes before, but here's the weirdness of my VHS collecting. I collect James Bond movies on VHS, and nice. That is not to say that I'm trying to get every movie. The rule is, if I see one in the wild, because I do a lot of yard sailing, a lot of Goodwill. I mean, my nickname's Yard Sale Artist, for goodness sake. If I see a Bond movie on VHS in the wild and my cap is $3, if it's $3 or less, I'm obligated to buy it. And I currently have 182 James Bond videotapes.
Wow.
I've been doing this for about 2 years now. And I've accumulated 182 Bond tapes. And if you have any follow-up questions for that, I'm prepared to answer.
Wow. Okay. I mean, I do. Yeah. Actually, I do. Before I jump into my lasso, I've got some questions. Now, I know you've answered this on your own show before, but for folks who maybe have not listened to your guys' amazing James Bond episodes, who's your favorite Bond and why?
Ah, excellent question. Yes. We actually, Longbox Crusade crew migrates over to another channel that we don't actually own. On Her Majesty's Secret Podcast is owned by Van Allen Plexico. And we do a James Bond show over there. So yes, you came to the right guy. That you're looking for. I am a Timothy Dalton guy.
Yep.
Timothy Dalton did two movies in the late 80s, and I think that's why he's my favorite. I think you kind of fall in love, and this isn't universal, but I think in a large portion of the Bond community, I think you fall in love with the Bond that when you start going to the movies,
yeah,
you know, you go to the movies when you're 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, and it's kind of fun, but when you start really going to the movies and enjoying the whole experience, when you're about 12, 13, that's when Dalton was in the theater, and that's what I was seeing. And I just love his portrayal. I love his hard edge. I love how he brought the Fleming-ness to the character. Yes. Long before Daniel Craig got credit for it, Timothy Dalton did it first. And honestly, while we're talking about very attractive people, he's just a handsome dude. He's just good-looking guy. So, Timothy Dalton's my guy.
He's still a good-looking guy. I mean, he's amazing in Hot Fuzz. Like, he is phenomenal in that movie. It's funny that you mentioned that, because I was going to say, so my favorite, and I've had, same thing, Roger Moore was my Bond in the theaters, and I loved Moonraker, and I loved, what's the one with Grace Jones? Time to Kill?
View to a Kill.
View to a Kill, sorry. Liked Roger Moore a bunch, liked Dalton, Brosnan was amazing. Daniel Craig definitely won me over as, I liked the, like you said, the Fleming-ness. I liked the brute, and kind of getting to see Bond from the ground up. But it is really funny, because I eventually went back and watched a bunch of former Bonds, and I had the same moment where I was like, oh, there's no Craig without Dalton. I mean, Dalton grounds Bond in a way that Bond really needed after Moore. I mean, I love Moore, but Moore, they dialed up the silliness a bit. And Dalton brings it right back down. And I think that's, I'm glad to hear you say that, because I don't think he gets enough credit.
I concur. And yeah, full love and respect to Roger Moore. And he was the fun Bond. And that's my favorite thing about Bond. Welcome to the Bondcast, by the way, everyone. my favorite thing about it is there's a Bond movie for every mood. You know, if you're just going to lay back, have some, put on a View to a Kill. If you want to go back to classic, put on Connery. If you, want that Dalton, you want to be depressed for a little while, do the Daniel Craig.
I mean, he really is sad Bond. He really is.
They're like outside Bond, of the first one he did. I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but outside of Casino, you don't leave on a happy. And Casino still kind of wishy-washy.
Casino still ends on a sad note. Yeah,
it does because of what happened to Vesper. But I mean, at least he says my name is Bond, James Bond. And the music swells, and you go, "Oh yeah!" At the end of Casino. After that, they're all depressing. They all end on a sad note.
Oh my god, that is true. That is true. Okay, so I'm just going to keep with the Bondcast theme here for a second, because I don't know if I'll ever get a chance to ask you this. So I'm not going to ask you who do you think the next Bond should be. I actually have a little a different version of it. If you could name any actor from any time frame to be Bond, who would it be? So it doesn't have to be somebody current, and it could be somebody current but in a younger age. Anybody, who would you love to have seen as Bond?
Man, that's not something I've given a ton of thought to, surprisingly enough.
It's a tough question. I mean, I Idris Elba, I think, as a younger man, would have been an amazing Bond.
Yes, a younger Idris Elba. Now that he's in his 50s, by the way, people keep kind of talking about Idris Elba. And I'm like, he's too old for it. He's still good looking and all that. But I'd go Bond comics, by the way. And in the Bond comics from Dynamite, M is black. And I'm like, Idris would be great for that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He's black and he's a bit more action oriented. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, Idris would be a fantastic M. Anyway, I sidetracked. Honestly, this is such a low hanging fruit answer. I'm almost embarrassed, but like, I don't think they're going to do it, because I think he's also just getting slightly too old. But that Henry Cavill in his prime, I swear that man was probably designed to be Bond at some point. Yeah. And if they did pick him, even just for like one movie, because, he's getting a little older too, but he still looks great. So yeah, I know it's such an easy answer, but Henry Cavill's just fantastic.
No, look, it's a good one. It's a really good one. I mean, it's funny because I think about even, like American actors. I'm blanking on the guy who played Remo Williams.
That's Fred Ward, and Fred, I love him, and I love Remo Williams.
Yeah, he would have been a great Bond. He would have been a fun Bond.
let me just tell you something that's maybe been gnawing on the back of your brain that you never even knew about. Remo Williams was directed by a James Bond director.
Was it really?
It was, yeah. And one of the writers of it was a Bond writer.
Oh, there you go. Okay, that makes a ton of sense.
There is Bond DNA in Remo Williams, for sure.
Yeah, that is, I think for men, and maybe women, but people of a certain age, I think we're right in that pocket where HBO just showed Remo Williams again and again and again during one, I don't even know what summer it was, but that movie lives in my heart. Like I still remember that movie as like one of the great action movies of the 80s.
Oh man, if you were to ask me, and you didn't, but I'm gonna answer anyway, like my favorite like book series, you might think it'd be Bond, but maybe it is, but the fact that there's like two, three, there might be before, I don't know, quote unquote, literally hundreds of Remo Williams, the book series is called The Destroyer.
Yeah.
That there's literally hundreds of stories and we got one movie.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
It really is. It really is. I'm like, that's so funny, man. I did not see this episode talking about Remo.
It all comes back to Remo.
It does. It really does. Well, so Jared, I'm going to grab Diana's magic lasso and I've got a silly story, but it's kind of inspired by this episode, because this episode takes place with Diana on a visit to the modern Greece of 1987, but modern Greece. And I have actually been to Greece and have traveled Europe. And so people have heard me talk about this before, but when I was a young teacher, I used to chaperone trips in the summer overseas because it was a free way to travel. I mean, I'd literally go to, multiple countries a summer. I'd get to see amazing sights and, I chaperoned kids, and it's what I did for a living anyway. So it didn't feel very different than what I was used to. And it was just the only way I was ever going to get to see the world. And so this issue reminds me of my first time traveling to Greece. It was actually a trip to Italy and then Greece. And so I was chaperoning this group. It was probably about 27 kids. And we were visiting Michelangelo's David. We were going to Florence, and we were going to go see that famous statue. And so in this student group that I'm chaperoning, this young kid, I'm going to call him Sam. It's not his real name, and I'm not going to use his real name. And Sam had been a freshman in my English class that year, so I knew him really well. And he was this, like, sweet, sheltered boy from a very religious household. And actually, in retrospect, I think he was homeschooled until eighth grade. So ninth grade was, like, the first time he had gone to public school. And I especially wanted to kind of keep an eye out for him because I knew he just didn't have the same exposure to the world that maybe some of my other kids had. So we're in Florence, you know, amazing city. Our tour guide's busting us through all these back alleys so that we get in to see David. And we cut the line, which is what great tour guides do. And as we go in, I pull Sam aside and I go, hey, you know this statue is a nude, right? And are you okay with that? And he laughs and he's like, Mr. Ross, I'm not a baby. I can handle a nude statue. And I'm like, okay, just check him. Well, what we didn't know was that the building in which David is housed, and David is huge, is an art museum in and of itself. And the Italian government had multiple art installations where David was located. And I guess we just happened to be there on a day where, to contrast the, like, classic beauty and just pageantry of the David statue, they went real postmodern. And on the ceiling, and these domed, like, arched ceilings all the way down this hall that was probably, I don't know, it had to be like 200 yards. It was an incredibly large art installation. On the ceiling were these paintings, and they were these backgrounds with, like, pastels and flowers and rainbows and, like, little Disney creatures and, you know, this very pastoral scene. But juxtaposed against it, the entire length of the ceiling was a gigantic photo of the artist who painted the ceiling, an elderly gentleman, but he was nude and he was, how do I say this? He was standing at full attention. And so we walk in and I'm looking for David, and I'm also just kind of doing a quick head count of my kids and making sure everything's going all right. And all of a sudden I see Sam walk in, eyes dart upward to the ceiling, and he literally falls to the floor. He falls on his knees and he goes, no, naked man, old man, naked, erection, no, old man, naked. And I'm like, what the hell? And I look up and I was like, oh my God. And so I literally had to pull this kid up off the floor. I had to walk him to a corner where it was harder to see the art installation. I had to calm him down. And then eventually, like, I'm like, I need to leave you to go see David. This is the one time in my life I might get to see this. I'm like, do you want to come with me? I'm like, I won't let you look up. We'll just walk in. We'll look at David. We'll walk out. And he looks at me and he says, it's my favorite line of the whole trip. And he goes, no, Mr. Ross. He says, I've seen enough peepees for one day. And so that was one of my favorite moments on that trip. So that poor kid, who's now an adult, had a chance to go to Florence, see Michelangelo's David, and had it ruined by one of the craziest art pieces I've ever seen. So yeah, just shows you that, you know, there's sort of an interesting range of art, and not all art is for every person.
I like how he was mentally prepared originally. Oh, yeah. And just got torpedoed.
Oh, literally
by the old man with junk exhibition.
And look, I'm not actually mocking the kid, because even I, when I looked up, went, oh my God, like, it was, I don't know what perspective they used.
it was too much.
yeah. It was a fisheye lens. It may have been another kind of eye lens, but it was like a fisheye lens. And definitely, like, it was a little too Captain EO given the subject matter. Like, there was a little too much 3D happening. And so, yeah, so this poor kid. But anytime I think about Greece, or anytime I think about travel, I think about poor Sam. And I also think about how he is a grown man now, probably has a family and everything. And I wonder how he tells that story, because I wonder if it's like, oh, hey, there's this funny thing that happened when I traveled once, or if he's like, hey, you, like, you know, the, like, it's like a trauma he's had to process in therapy.
it's something.
It's something, man. It's something. There is nothing like traveling with kids across the world. It's always interesting. So that takes us from Diana's magic lasso to the issue itself. And I'm going to provide a brief summary of the issue. Issue 18 of Wonder Woman Volume 2 is called Creatures in the Dark, and it continues Diana's visit to Julia's childhood home in Greece, where we meet Julia's parents and other members of the community. Now, Diana's recovering from a bizarre episode she had last issue, where she passed out on a boat. Now, we know this was a magical attack from a witch on an island who we know is Cersei, but Diana does not. So the dark forces of Cersei continue to close in on Diana, eventually attacking Julia's friend Stavros and Vanessa, Julia's daughter, driving Diana to confront Cersei's army of animal men and women. Diana looks like she's going to win the night, but Cersei strikes her from the heavens and Diana falls. Meanwhile, Zeus and his brothers meet in the primordial darkness to plan for the building of a new Olympus. So, Jared, as we jump into the issue, I'm going to put you in a familiar role from your own show. Do you mind describing the cover for the listeners?
Sure. This is an interesting cover, especially for Wonder Woman, because it is much darker than one would expect from a Wonder Woman cover. It is a lot of black, gray tones, muted yellow. Anyways, Wonder Woman logo is understated in the top right corner, and it's just in a white font, which lays nicely over the very dark cover. Keeping with the darkness, the DC Bullet logo in the top left is black and white. And your main action is Wonder Woman, and she's sort of cowering and cradling a child in her hands as all these monsters of the night are cresting this hill and sort of coming down upon them behind the pale moonlight. And that's kind of what's going on.
So I'm especially interested in your view of this cover because you're an artist, and I love this cover, and I like the way that you mentioned this, the logo gets out of the way of the cover art, which I'm sure George had a huge hand in. I mean, he's one of the premier artists of the time and could probably say to DC, hey, you know, move the logo for a minute. But it's I think this is a really striking cover, like you said, because it's so different. This series has tended to have brighter, shinier, sort of more iconic covers. And this is one of those rare times where Perez goes and depicts a scene, you know, kind of from the book, and it is really kind of bone chilling. And so is there anything that as an artist that you think Perez did especially well to like drive home the goal of this cover? Or is there anything just, I don't have that same eye you have. Is there anything in here that you're like, oh wow, that was a really cool touch?
Yes. And it's so stupid. the grass on the bottom. Oh, I'm looking, yeah. I'm like, that is so George will spend details on. I remember we had one of his Teen Titans books on Longbox Crusade many years ago, and I was just marveling at how he drew the rocks in the back.
Yeah.
Like, and he's doing it again, except if you look at these, like, he has spent some time on the blades of grass that Wonder Woman and the girl are cowering in. And it caught my eye. I was like, look at the detail in that grass. And of course, it's kind of juxtaposed too, because all of his monster creatures are all in silhouette. There's no detail in them.
Yeah.
Everything's in silhouette. And it's, as we're coming closer to the quote unquote camera, you're getting more detail. So you get silhouetted monsters in the sort of background. Middle ground is Wonder Woman and the girl, and they have a fair amount of detail. And then your very, very foreground is that grass, which has an exceptional amount of detail. So yeah, that's what grabbed me.
Well, and I think it's especially effective because you can feel it. You know, as a viewer, like, you've laid in grass, you can almost hear the wind going through it. And Wonder Woman, Diana and Vanessa are clearly trying to hide from these monsters, and they're not in a very, they're very out in the open, even though they're trying to hide. It reminds me of that scene in Fellowship of the Ring, where the hobbits are hiding from the Nazgul in the forest, and they, like, the Nazgul are up and the hobbits are like down in this little burrow, and they kind of clop right by them. And it's terrifying. And I just think he does such a good job of really driving home the fear in this issue, the fear in this cover. And it's definitely something that jumped out at me. I remember it jumping out at me as a kid. And then I was really looking forward to getting to this issue again, even early on before I had kind of gone through, I'm reading along with the series, before I had read the issue and remembered what was coming along with it, because I was like, man, whatever is happening in that comic is super scary. So like, it's, yeah, just an amazing, amazing cover. Do you have, just again, I love having people on the show who are artists, especially people who are talented in ways where I have zero talent. Do you have a favorite cover artist of all time?
Of all time? That's woo.
I mean, just, how about your favorite cover woo. Artist of all time right now?
Ooh, my goodness. I didn't see that one coming. I'm prepared. There's so many that I love. Great. You know what? Because I cover so much G.I. Joe, I'll tell you the first one popped in my head was Mike Zeck.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, me too.
And I mean, he didn't just do G.I. Joe, but G.I. Joe was on my mind as you were going through your description of the cover, because it definitely reminds me of G.I. Joe Special Missions 6? somewhere in there where Outback is in the snow hiding in this very similar pose as the Barovians are looking for him. That's what put me in mind of. So yeah, you got me with like the first one on my brain would have to be Mike Zeck, especially when inked by John Beatty, although you know, everybody that works with Zeck is talented, but that those Beatty Zeck covers of the '80s are very high on my list.
I mean, he is, my mind immediately went to Zeck as well. And yeah, those G.I. Joe covers, I mean, his, you know, like solo Storm Shadow covers. And I just, yeah, there's so many amazing covers to G.I. Joe that,
I mean,
that,
we didn't even talk about his run on like Cap.
Punisher,
Wars and blah, 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 blah. Zeck is just incredible.
Yeah, yeah, amazing, amazing cover artist. I just am blown away by him. And I think, you know, Perez obviously is in there for me. Zek's in there for me. Brian Bolland was phenomenal. You know, Byrne obviously was always great. Yeah. I'm trying to think of, I don't know if you follow any modern comics, but like there are some really great, Jenny Friesen is a really great cover artist. Joel Jones. There's some really good ones now too, where David Nakamura. There's some cover artists who, even if I don't love an issue, I'll always stop and look at it if they've got a cover on it.
Yeah, it's funny because I did kind of fall out of comics around 06 when I started having kids.
Mm-hmm.
And so like my wheelhouse is sort of everything before that.
Oh, no, but no,
like,
yeah, I get it.
These people you're mentioning though, like I know them because of my convention appearances. Like I've seen them at cons have these wonderfully long lines and I'm like, oh, I have no idea who that person is. But now that you're naming them, I'm like, oh yeah, that person had a really long line at Heroes Con, you know, 2 years ago or whatever. So it makes sense that they would have this long line because they're the stalwart cover artist.
Yeah.
And that's great.
It is really cool. It's become kind of a, I don't love this because I'm a comic reader more than I am a comic collector, but I do, there's this whole market now for like specialty covers by certain artists. And part of me actually really likes that because it's treating comic art more like art pieces, which I think they should be. I think that's really, really cool. And so I like the spirit of it. And I like it because it allows for some funkier. Like, have you ever seen Daniel Warren Johnson? Okay, I think you would love him. He did like Do a Power Bomb and
yeah, we had Do a Power Bomb on Crusadeness. Rick Resent brought it. So that's how I know him.
Yeah. Yeah. He's amazing.
Incredibly energetic art. Incredibly energetic.
Yeah, I describe him as like if Walt Simonson, Jeff Darrow, and if they had like a crack baby.
I see the Walt Simonson especially, yes.
Yeah, yeah, that's amazing. So we go into the issue itself, and this is a sort of typical Perez issue in that there's a lot of world building happening. Before we get to the actual, like there's not a battle with Cersei in here. We're building up to it, which makes sense because Cersei's one of Wonder Woman's big bads. And this is the post-crisis introduction of her. And so the series, the issue actually opens with Poseidon, Zeus, and Hades all at the primordial chaos where the Titans fell. So for folks who know their Greek mythology, the Titans there was darkness, there was chaos, and then there were the Titans. So Gaia is the earth, Cronus is time, and there were a whole group of them. Cronus and Gaia start having children, and there's a prophecy that one of Cronus's children will rise up to overpower him and destroy him. So Cronus starts eating his children as they're born. He consumes them. These are the Olympian gods. So Gaia, not wanting Cronus to consume all of her children, wraps Zeus in like a swaddling cloth, sends him to Earth, and gives Cronus a rock. So apparently that tells you what babies taste like. I mean, like he gets a rock and he pops it in his mouth and he doesn't notice the difference. And so Zeus goes down to Earth, grows into his power, and then comes back, attacks Cronus, frees the Olympians, murders Cronus, and the Titans are varyingly either murdered or imprisoned, depending on where they sided in the war. But they meet where Cronus fell, which is this primordial chaos, and his like skeleton is there. And it's a really cool meeting because they are there to grab the original pact they made to divvy up the universe. Basically, Zeus gets the sky, Poseidon gets the seas, Hades gets the underworld, and then all the gods sort of rule over the earth. And they're there to renew the compact in the creation of a new Olympus. And so I'm just curious, you know, Jared, what were your thoughts on this as the opening scene of something sort of this majestic happening to open the issue?
I enjoyed it because, you know, I know that Wonder Woman is tied to this lore so very, very strongly. I swear that kids of a certain age, those of us who grew up in the 80s, kind of all remember in our library, there was this very large scale books about Greek mythology and Roman mythology that I, for some reason, I think they only existed for like 8 years, like between 80 and 88. I never see them anymore. I've never seen them in my yard sale, my Goodwills, my library adventures. I've never seen them again, but everybody remembers them. And so I really enjoy this facet of it because of that. Like, I just had these strong memories, especially of the Greek gods book. And so this definitely brought that back. And I thought, oh, okay, yeah, I'm on board. I see what's going on. I know who these characters are. I know what's up. And very enjoyable. Yes.
Just a quick question. I remember, yeah, I read all those books too. There was like Bullfinch's mythology and Hamilton's mythology and all these other amazing books on mythology. I remember mythology more from Dungeons and Dragons, which I played as a kid. Did you play D&D as a kid?
Did play a little bit of D&D, especially my older brother Jason, the Weasel Skull himself, was a D&D kid. And so I was sort of, you know, he was of more of that age because he's 5 years older than me. Uh-huh. I was sort of like, oh, I had a little cleric that I.
Oh, nice.
So I'd, you know, anytime my brother would include me in something was special to me. So
yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. And cleric is a very little brother role because no one actually no one wants to be the cleric, even though in the end, the cleric is the most important character in the party. But yeah, that's a very older brother assigning a little brother a role. So Jared, this opening scene actually brings me to my first secret question of the episode. So the issue opens with Zeus, Hades, and Poseidon returning to Chaos, where the dead Titans reside. They bind their powers to create a new Olympus. So my question is about the creation of a world or worlds. So in any medium, it can be comics, TVs, movies, real life. What is your favorite creation myth for the world or a universe or a people? And if you need some time to think, I can go first. But if you're ready, you can go ahead and go.
I did go out of my way to not look at your secret question.
Okay, let me go first.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I do the same thing. I like to be surprised by the secret question. So. One of my favorite sort of creation stories in comics is in the Legion of Superheroes. And so the Legion of Superheroes is always 1,000 years ahead of whatever time we are now. So, you know, the 31st century. And they're made up of all of these teenagers at certain times in their mythos who are from planets. And often those planets, they're not the person on the planet with superpowers. Often the entire planet has those powers. Like everybody from Brawl has magnetic abilities like Cosmic Boy. Everybody from Polar Boy's planet has ice powers because they're from a superheated planet. And so Imsk, where Shrinking Violet's from, everybody shrinks. It's actually just part of it's who they are as a people. So I've always thought that was really, really cool. And at one point in Legion mythology, and I don't remember if it's during the Paul Levitz run or if it's during the 5 years later or the Archie Legion. Somebody will listen and correct me. But it's established that one of the reasons so many planets in the universe have people who have what appear to be superpowers, and those people from those planets are humanoid, they're indistinguishable from humans, is because Mon-El, the sort of Superman figure of the Legion, who's actually from the 20th century, I mean, he first appears in the Silver Age as Superman's brother, and before Superman has to trap him in the Phantom Zone, he, at one point in the 20th century, 21st century, leaves Earth, and he goes off to, like, kind of be a hero in the universe, and he seeds the planets, basically. They call it, like, the I forget what the term they use, but effectively, he, like, procreates on all of these planets and leaves humanoid sort of figures, and then he has a multitude of superpowers. He's basically Superman. And that, like, superhero potential or those powers sort of empowers those people and those races moving forward. So it's a really cool in-universe explanation for why there are so many human-looking planets and people and why so many folks in that universe have planets that where everybody has what appears to be a superpower. So I don't know. I just always thought that was kind of neat. What about you?
Well, first of all, that is very cool. I didn't know that. I mean, I know of the Legion and I've dabbled in the Legion a little bit, but I didn't know that lore. That's pretty cool. Creation myths, huh? I'll tell you what came to mind, and it's not quite what you're talking about, but I think it's in the ballpark.
Okay.
I've always been fascinated with the thought that this current era today, here in 2026, that this could potentially be the second iteration of man.
Oh,
like man could have been evolved or created, with, you know, whatever your belief system is, gone through its entire peak to civilization to crumble, to crumbled and forgotten for millions of years, and then second cycle or third or fourth. Like, I've always been fascinated with that concept. And I remember the first time I ever saw it actually done in a movie. And I think it depends on it does depend on which version of the movie you see. It's Highlander 2.
Oh, nice.
Because I think the original cut, the Highlanders were from another planet.
Uh-huh.
And they got rid of that in the Renegade cut. And that's where they said, they're actually from the first iteration of man. And I always thought that's a fascinating thing. Because if there was a version of man that had been on this planet so far long ago that literally nothing remains, nothing. That, to me, that's fascinating. And I had that thought even as I think the Renegade cut came out in like 1992. Four or something like that. But even as a teenager, I had sort of marinated on it. And I'm certainly not the first person to think of it. I don't know where it first appeared, but like, it just, I was like, that's such a fascinating thing to think about. So when I saw it in the Renegade cut of the movie, I thought, oh wow, I'm not the only person that ever thought of that. So that's my kind of close to the answer.
I think that's super cool. And I love when stories have that kind of twist. So like, were you a fan at all of the Battlestar Galactica reboot?
Dabbled in it a little bit, liked what I saw, but I didn't like sit down and watch it all.
So it's one of my favorite shows of all time. I think it's one of the best, if not the best, reboots of all time. And that show, and the ending of it is controversial. Some people love it, some people don't. But effectively, just like in the original Battlestar Galactica, they're searching for Earth. They're searching for the like this mythical, like 12th tribe, basically, that is Earth. And they land, so sorry, spoilers for a 20-year-old show at this point. But that series, the reboot series, ends with them finding Earth, but it turns out they're actually the humans who establish Earth.
Establish it. Okay, yeah. I got you. Yeah, yeah. No, and that's cool.
And it is cool because like their mythology all the way through that series is like Greek gods. Like they worship Athena and they worship Zeus. And so it's this explanation of why we have those gods somewhat early in our history of humanity. And there is this implication that they're there to establish like our culture, but they may not exactly be the first humans. And so I think it's cool. I love that answer, man. It also reminds me of some of my favorite old like Johnny Quest stories with lizard men. Like, I just love the idea that there are lizard men under the earth.
Yes, I believe there are.
I think it's great, man. The world would be better if there were lizard men under the earth.
Lizard men always make things more exciting.
They really do. So back to the comic, we've got this establishment of a new Olympus that's going to be a big story point moving forward. But now we cut back to Diana. Diana's in a Greek hospital and she's, you know, recovering. The doctor's basically like literally says to her, "You are the healthiest person I've ever seen in my life. There's nothing I can offer you." He's like, do you want drugs? And she's like, "I don't do drugs." He's like, "Okay, then leave. There's nothing I can do for you."
Perhaps give you a body massage.
Yeah. Basically, like every person who encounters Diana, there is a brief moment of flirtation followed immediately by a self-correction of, no, you're too good for me. Like, it's, you know, it's this wonderful thing where every man and woman that meets her is like, oh, and there's a flirt and then a nope, actually, sorry, my bad.
There's out of your league and then there's out of your universe.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, this is like, I mean, you apologize to her for breathing the same air, basically. Like, you're like, I'm so sorry if my breathing offended you. It's so she's, you know, recovering, and she gets invited by the wealthiest man on the island to come to dinner, and he'll tell her he's got a big collection of writings about the island, and Diana's fascinated by the idea that there's this witch on the island, and Julia poo-poos it, and other people are like, she's just an old woman, and Julia's like, this is what they've done to women for centuries, anybody who's different, they call her a witch, and Diana has a funny moment where she's like, y'all have met me, right? Like I fly, I talk to Zeus, like I know Pan, I know gods. Witches for me are like a Tuesday. Like that, those are real things to me. So if there is a witch, I'm going to believe there's a witch. And so she has this kind of funny interaction with them. And we go back to Julia's house and we learn that her father and brother fought in the Greek resistance in World War II, and that her brother died. We learned that Julia was married and you know, had a real love for her husband. I do have a question for you. She says they were together for 22 years before he died. How old do you think Julia is based on the way Perez draws her?
All right, let me get my glasses on.
And her parents too. Looking at her parents and then looking at her.
Based on the way she's drawn. And forgive me if it's taking me a little while because this comic, I swear, has 826 characters to keep up with.
Yeah, it really is a dense comic.
Julia's
I'm
got
sorry.
The short.
Yeah, short white
blonde,
hair.
Maybe white hair, wears glasses.
Yeah. Well, so her mom is the one with the glasses. Her dad's the one coughing with the white beard. Christmas. And then Julia's the other one. Yeah.
Okay, wait. So Julia.
She's got white hair, but not glasses. Her mom's the one with the glasses.
Okay. Yeah. I think I see her. Yes.
I mean, if you were just scanning this comic, how old do you think she was?
I see her now. 45.
Okay. Okay. So that's interesting. Cause when I look at her, I think Perez, I'm like, God, Perez kind of missed the mark. Cause to me, she always reads like she's in her like late 60s, you know,
this may be where I'm getting confusing. There may be pages where it's her, but I think it's her mom. You know?
So basically I'm on page 7. If you look at the second panel, there's three older folks. The mom's on the right, the dad's in the middle, and Julia's on the left.
Okay, yeah. Oh, I was looking at the right person then. Yeah. Okay. I feel like her parents are probably 70 and that she's about 45.
Okay. Yeah, maybe it's just me. I've always felt like Perez draws her because Vanessa's only 14. And I'm like, wow, okay, so she has a 14-year-old. And you know, some people choose to have kids later in life. That's not a big deal, but
tell me all about it.
Yeah, I waited too. So yeah, let me tell you. So it's fun to show up at parent teacher conferences and see my daughter's peers' parents and be like, oh, I could be your father.
Yeah, which one of these kids is your grandson?
Exactly. Yeah. So I totally get it. I'm not in any way age shaming, but I've always felt like Perez draws her kind of older than she should be. And then even her parents feel like they're kind of in their 90s. So I wonder what age she was when she had Vanessa. So just something that's always bugged me. But, you know, and that's it's not a big deal. But yes, there are so many characters in this book. So actually, it Diana talking to Julia about her husband and Julia talking about, you know, we were married for 22 years. And Diana's really confused about marriage. She's like, I don't get it. I don't get this practice. Like, it doesn't make any, and then the woman has to change their last name. That seems like, you know, why does the woman have to do it, not the man? Which are just fun little moments for George to include. Because, of course, an Amazon would be like, wait, what? Like, what is that about? I just.
Yeah, none of that would make sense. But no. Steve Trevor will fix all that.
Yeah, exactly. And I have a funny story. I don't know. So when you married, did your wife take your last name?
She did indeed.
Okay. So when I got married, my wife and I met in college. We met our senior year at Arizona State. And my wife is amazing, but very, and this is what I love about her, very headstrong, very independent. And so when we were dating and knew kind of where everything was headed, knew we were going to get engaged, she's like, I just want you to know I'm not changing my name. And I was like, okay, like, that's cool. I'm not changing mine either. So like, you know, no big deal. She's like, no. She's like, is it going to bug you if I don't change my name? And I'm like, not in any way. I go, again, I'm not being asked to change mine. So I get that this is an unfair practice. It's cool. You don't have to change your name. So anyway, we get married and we're married for like, I don't know, 6 months, 7 months. And I'm in the kitchen one day and I'm washing dishes and she comes home and she holds up something next to my head and she goes, look. And I turn around and I go, what? And she goes, look, and it's her driver's license. And I go, cool, it's your driver's license. You can drive. I've known that about you for a long time. She goes, no, look closer. And I look, and she changed her last name. And I go, oh, my God. I go, whoa. And she did not talk to me about this at all, by the way. I go, oh, my God, I can't believe you changed your last name. I'm like, well, what prompted it? So she proceeds to go into this whole like, well, I was really struggling with the idea of being a wife and, you know, binding myself to somebody in a patriarchal tradition. But then I realized how much I loved you and I went and changed it. And I start laughing and I go, you are so full of crap. I go, you changed your last name because your last name was Frumpkin and my last name is Ross. And Ross is so much better than Frumpkin. And she goes, oh, my God. And then she goes, yeah, you're right. You're right. It's just a better name. I had to change it. So I'm like, yeah. Totally sucks. She totally tried to snow me.
She tried to go highfalutin on you. And you're like, yeah. Let's still go to the brass tacks
here. Yeah. She tries to make it a sign of her unending love for me. But really, it's just the fact that her maiden name was such a bad name that when she was in seventh grade PE, her PE coach would go, where is Frumpkin? Where is Frumpkin? So anyway.
I had that question about, and you can edit this out if you want, but like my wife's Puerto Rican and it's very common for them to hyphenate when they get married. and she chose not to. I think her big thing was she never had a middle name. So she took the opportunity to take her last name. She took her last name and moved it to middle.
That's cool.
Mine her last name. So it's kind of the same thing.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. So yeah, it's a funny thing. I mean, so anytime I see anything about marrying and names, I always laugh because my wife's whole sacrifice for our love.
I mean, I don't want to make her mad or anything, but I'd take Ross over from.
Oh my God, are you kidding me? Like I laughed so hard. I was like,
I mean, unless you want to sound like you're from the Tolkien universe.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. Yeah. That's what I said to her. I go, it's because your maiden name sounds like you're a human beaver from Narnia. Like, you know, come on. So this actually, in a weird way, brings me to my second secret question of the episode. So, and this one's up maybe a little more serious, but you can take it any way you want. So Julia's love for her deceased husband, it really does shine through. Like you can tell in the dialogue, you can tell in the way she talks to Diana that she very much loved this man and is you know, even still is heartbroken that he has passed. So in any medium, but actually also just real life, is there a love story that inspires you?
But I'll keep it light. I won't go too deep into personal life or anything like that. But I will say I will pick the medium of comic books. And I think my favorite relationship in comics is Peter and Mary Jane.
Oh, okay. Nice.
And I know that right about the time I fell out of comics was Brand New Day.
Yeah.
And that upset a lot of people. And I think it would have upset me more if I had stuck with comic books too, because I've always hated this concept of, oh, if Peter's married, then he's boring.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that. Don't you realize how much higher the stakes are now?
Uh-huh.
And how much more, like when Superman, like Clark and Lois is like a close second for me.
Yeah.
That one's almost hard. That one actually could be first because it's like Highlander. It's like, you know, it can't be forever.
Mm-hmm.
And that's heartbreaking.
Yeah. You know?
When you think about Clark and Lois. And I think they kind of address that in Mark Waid's very famous four-parter that just fell out of my head.
Oh,
Kingdom Come.
Kingdom Come, yeah.
Yeah. So I just think because of those two examples we just gave, Peter and Clark and with MJ and Lois, like I hate that concept that, oh, if they're married, they're boring. They gotta have this rotation of women. And it's like, no, like honestly, Peter's relationship with women, because you know, we do Amazing Spider-Man Chronicles online.
Yeah, yeah.
It's fun, sure, whatever. But to me, I mean, I was reading those comics in the 80s off the shelf. When he got married to Mary Jane, it got a whole new level to it.
It did. It got, those comics got better.
They did. And it's like, because all that other stuff is sort of background noise and it's flirty and it's fun, but it's much more interesting to have Peter have that responsibility to share his secret with someone, to watch her protect his secret as well.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much you can get out of that. So you keep it in a more lighthearted fare and in comic book world, I will say Peter and MJ are my favorite couple, and with Lois and Clark probably in my second
place. Yeah, I love both those couples. The thing with Peter and MJ in particular, the thing I always liked about them is not only were they, not only did it raise the stakes, but like, artists and writers at the time were unafraid to give them like a sex life. Like they had an edge to them that a young couple should have, which I know sounds weird, but like where so many couples in comics are so chaste, or, you know, there's just this like, I don't know, that, you know, there's this like element of life that's missing. I always really appreciate it. And half of it was because Todd McFarlane was drawing her, I guess, you know, but I mean, you know, Todd McFarlane,
I know the issues you're talking about.
Oh, yeah. 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 Todd McFarlane knew how to draw a nighty. He, you know, I think part of it was that. And I always liked how playful they were. And it's funny because I didn't get that same vibe for a long time with Lois and Clark, but actually recently they've really played that sort of fun aspect up of the two of them. So I think I told this story in a recent episode, but I like it again. So there was a recent storyline in Superman where he goes to War World, where Mongol's at. And, you know, it's a story you've seen before, and he has to fight in the arena. So he's in this, like, you know, gladiator outfit. And so he, you know, he survives, he overcomes, he defeats Mongol, he comes back home. And he and Lois have a son, John. And John goes into their closet to look for something. And he goes, whoa, hey, what's this? He's like, Mom, why did you keep Dad's outfit from war? And then he stops talking. And she's like, uh-huh. She's like, none of your business. She's like, just walk away.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and it's a cute moment to remind you that, like, you know, Lois and Clark are, you know, still young and fun. And I'm going to stay in comics, too. I'm going to go light. I've always loved Jay and Joan Garrick. So Jay Garrick, the original Flash Society. He and Joan Garrick are love interests when he becomes the Flash, even though she's actually horrible to him. They're college contemporaries. She refuses to go out with him. She thinks he's a loser. And then he becomes the Flash, and she kind of finds out he's the Flash and then falls in love with him. So I wouldn't say it's a great start. But one of the things I've always loved about them is one of the storylines for them is that they were unable to have children. And so what that evolves into is they become like the mom and dad for the entire Flash family. You know, for Barry, for Wally, for Bart, for everybody in that part of the universe. And I just think that's always so cool. I love like this older couple as, you know, universal mom and dad. And like they love each other, but they also love everybody who comes into their lives. So I just have always thought they were a really cool couple.
Weren't they basically the adoptive parents of Impulse?
Yeah. So for a bit, they effectively take him in and help raise him.
Yeah, I was reading Impulse pretty heavily back in the day. Yeah. I seem to remember that.
Yeah, I love Jay Garrick. I love Jay and Joan Garrick. And it's funny because even – and I know these are comic book characters, so it's what the writers did. But there's even this great episode of Brave and the Bold – or issue of Brave and the Bold where Batman and Jay Garrick team up. And Batman is, like, super deferential to him. And at one point in his own, like, thought bubbles, he thinks, like, this is the – like, this guy started everything – this is like he even thinks to himself, like, don't be rude to him. And I'm like, oh my God, even Batman, like Batman even has manners when it comes to Jay Garrick.
Be rude. Like, cause that's his natural mode.
Yeah. He's such
don't a, be
he's
rude
such,
to this guy.
He's such a dick. He's like, don't be a bad dick. He's like, so we, Diana's in the hospital, but she decides to go to dinner at this rich man's house and kind of look up about the witch. Later, the rich man has a nephew. Again, there's so many characters in this book. The nephew was killed. They blame it on the rebels who are against the witch. And that activates everybody on the island who follows the witch to turn into these sort of animal people. I'm curious. So you are the artist of Hamilton versus Burr, Werewolf Tale.
Correction. I'm the writer. My buddy Nate drew it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
My buddy Nate drew it. Yes. I always have other people draw what I write. So if there's comics by me, I'm always the writer. Occasionally I've been an inker on a few books, but
okay. Yeah. But you're writer and artist, so you know your way around a monster. What are your thoughts on Perez's animal men for Cersei?
Oh, they're great. They're very much to me the highlight of the book. I like gravitate towards sort of monstery books. In fact, in Amazing Spider-Man Chronicles, we're just finished covering the arc where the tarantula turns into like a beast tarantula.
Oh yeah.
I love that kind of stuff. You know, this whole Bernie Wrightson kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, no, his designs are great. To me, they were very much a highlight of this issue.
That's awesome. It's funny. You mentioned Bernie Wrightson. So when I was a classroom teacher for 15 years, I still am an educator, but I'm not in the classroom anymore. But at one point in my career, I taught Frankenstein by Mary Shelley. And because I'm a comic book guy, I knew Bernie Wrightson had done these, like, I don't know if you've ever seen them, but his pencil drawings of Frankenstein, I mean, they are museum worthy. They're just
exquisite.
Oh my God, right? They're beautiful and intricate. I mean, the way that man draws a lab and a Bunsen burner and a beaker is like, it deserves to be in the Louvre. I mean, just phenomenal. So as part of that unit, when I taught it, I would bring those, I would photocopy those. And I would bring them in for kids to see because I knew I had kids who were artists and, you know, just you try to hit kids on a million different levels when you teach. You never know what'll hook them. So anyway, I have a kid who I teach as a freshman. You know, he goes through high school. He comes back. And like, I mean, I'm talking like 10 years later after I was his teacher. He comes back to the school to visit and he comes back to visit me and other teachers, but me in particular, because I had a really good relationship with him. And he's like, hey, he's like, Mr. Ross, do you still teach Frankenstein? And I'm like, oh, I haven't in a long time. I don't teach that grade anymore. I've moved to a different grade, you know, so different books. And I go, why? And he goes, do you remember? He goes, you may not remember this, but like you brought in art. And I go, oh, Bernie Wrightson. I go, yeah. I go, remember I'm a comic book guy. So Bernie Wrightson was like Swamp Thing and I love him. And he goes, yeah. And he goes, look, and he pulls his shirt sleeve up and he has an entire, like, I couldn't even see the whole thing because he didn't take his shirt off, but like he had an entire sleeve and back piece that was like the Bernie Wrightson, one of the Bernie Wrightson wow. Frankenstein images. And I was like, oh my God. I go, did you do that because of my class? And he's like, well, yeah, in part, because I discovered the art because of your class. And I go, oh my God, do your parents hate me? And he's like, I never blamed it on you. He's like, they don't love it. I go, but it is really good. I'm like, whoever did that's amazing. So yeah. Wow. So anyway, I like to think that I, you know, in as a teacher, not only help poison kids' minds, but you know, also their
the physical form as well.
Led them to tattoos, led them to full body tattoos. So Diana, there's an attack on Stavros's home while Vanessa is there by the animal men. Stavros is badly injured. Vanessa flees. Diana goes after her, finds her, but ends up fighting these animal creatures in the night. She does a really cool thing with her lasso. She encircles Vanessa almost in like a protective sigil. And then she's fighting them and she's winning. She's a brutal warrior. She's Wonder Woman. And then a bolt from the blue comes down and strikes her down. And it's Circe. We get our first look at Circe on the island saying basically like, okay, I've won. Now it's time for me to meet with Diana. So what were your thoughts on this final battle?
Highlight of the book. Like we said earlier, Perez clearly has a story he wants to tell here, and it's fairly intricate, and it's Perez, right? So he's somebody. He's a really, let me put it this way, he's a really good artist and he's an okay writer. Because I know I'm not specifically answering your question, but I'll get there.
Sure.
This book, I'm doing an overall kind of look here. I know that, but this book isn't terribly welcoming to a new reader.
Yeah, no, not at all.
Because you've been going through them, so I'm sure this makes a ton more sense to you than it does to me. Because this, I just read this one in and of itself. Have I read the stuff around it back in the 80s? Probably. But yeah. I just don't remember. So, like, to answer your question, and when we get to the action beat with the monsters at the end, yes, I'm very excited. I very much took away from this that this is our first appearance of Circe post-crisis. Once again, talking about his art skills, she's very sexy. And, mm-hmm. It's George, and I'm pretty sure her hair is doing some covering.
yes. Point. Oh yeah. Yeah.
but yeah, this whole beat when we get back, sort of the gods and the monsters and all that stuff, I'm locked in. It's definitely my favorite part of the book. Is very exciting to me. And yeah. I may be jumping ahead here as well, but while I've got the mic and I'm running my mouth, I don't know why George did this to himself.
Yeah.
Like, what I mean is, did you look at the panel count in this book?
Oh, it's insane.
It's nuts.
Yeah.
I'm like, it's like, again, this is a guy who has a story in his head to tell, and he can't get it out fast enough.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this really probably should have been a couple, three books.
I literally think it's probably, on average, it's probably like 8 to 9 panels per page. But there are several pages with like 12, 15, 16 panels. Yeah. And it's not Crisis on Infinite Earth. It's not 16 whatever plus panels because he's cramming in a ton of events and actions. It's more these like quick cuts for storytelling as people are having conversations. And look, it does keep it more visually interesting. And it's also just, I mean, it's like bow to the master. I mean, the guy is an unbelievable storyteller. And I just, and look, you know, it's funny that you mentioned it. I will say, I agree with you. There are issues in this run where I look at them and I go, individually, this is not a great comic. And it's certainly not new reader friendly. But in the like tapestry of the tale he's telling, he's paying so much attention to world building, and he's trying to make the world around Diana so lived in and mm-hmm. full.
And so
I love the effort, and I do actually love the result because it feels like a complete read.
This makes a great trade.
Yes. Yeah. That's just it. It reads much better in one sitting, especially an arc like this. But I do think, you know, and I'll be critical, I do think George drags the Circe arc out. I think we're already 2 issues in, and we've basically seen, like, Circe's ankle. You know, it's like 1920s OnlyFans or something. Like, you know, we don't get...
I'm into it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're definitely not getting, you know, it reminds me of that. You ever seen that tweet where about Surf Shark, where it's like, you know, in, back in the day, if there were a TV show called Surf Shark, he'd be shark surfing on the surfboard every episode, solving crimes. But today we'd have a 12 part miniseries and he'd only get the surfboard in the last 5 minutes. Yeah,
that's right. Yes.
And so there's a little bit of that with George, you know, kind of crafting this world and this lived in world. Now, again, it is definitely worth it because every Wonder Woman comic after George is living in this world. I mean, it is absolutely the template and the DNA for William Messner Loebs, John Byrne, Phil Jimenez, Greg Rucka, Tom King, everybody who comes after is basically, you know, really drawing on George's work, which is awesome. But yeah, it's a tough issue. It's a tough beat to come in kind of cold on. So I do actually, as we're coming to the end of the issue, I do have one last secret question. So in the issue itself, in the floppy, there is an ad for The Power of the Atom. And it was a new series that was coming out in 88. And it was by one of my favorite writers, Roger Stern, and Dwayne Turner on pencils. But the ad says, DC does it again. Like, we did it with Superman, they show Man of Steel. We did it with The Flash, they show the Wally West book. We did it with Wonder Woman, they show Perez. We did it with the Justice League, they show the Bwahaha League. Well, Power of the Atom definitely doesn't live up to... I don't know if you read that book. Not many did.
No, I don't think I did.
Yeah, and it's funny because, again, I love the creative team, but it definitely does not... It's not a book I've ever gone back to read. And even at the time, I remember going like, oh, this falls really flat. So it brings me to a secret question. And we can you can go negative or positive. I like to always give both options. So in any medium, so movie, TV, whatever, was there a revamp or a refresh that was announced that you were super looking forward to that either bombed for you or exceeded your expectations or both? So I can go first because I'm surprising you with this question. So I will tell you, I am a firm believer that no one should touch the Watchmen universe, that Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons crafted a perfect piece of literature. You know, not perfect, but anyway, they crafted a perfect story, 12 issues. It does not need a beat more. It does not need to be revisited. It does not need a prequel. They did the whole before Watchmen thing. I am a firm believer that you leave that work alone. And I've actually taught that work as part of a curriculum and it was awesome. My kids loved it. It was a blast to teach. And so when HBO did their Watchmen follow-up show, TV show by Damon Lindelof, the guy behind Lost, starring Regina King, I steadfastly refused to watch it. I was like, nope, there's not going to be anything additive to this universe. You're only going to screw things up. No one ever gets this right unless Alan Moore is writing the show. I'm not watching this. No, 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 no. And then enough people in my life told me, including people who were lifelong comic book fans, like, no, you don't get it. This is freaking amazing. That I finally like sat down to hate watch it. And I ended up finishing that show going, oh my God, they did it. Like, this is as good as the book. Like, this is a worthy successor to that comic book, which I never thought I'd be able to say aloud. So like, I totally was dreading it. I thought it was going to suck and it ended up blowing me away. What about you?
All right. I have a negative and a positive answer.
Okay.
And they're both in the same medium and they're both around the same character and they both came out about the same time. So Spider-Man, there's a lot of Spider-Man books. There's, you know, start with Amazing, then they had Spec and then Web and then Adjectiveless Spider-Man. And around about the late 90s, two books came out relatively close to the same time. One was a Spider-Man relaunch called Chapter One by John.
Oh, Byrne. Yeah.
I was like, John Byrne, high hopes. Let's just say it didn't pan out.
Nope.
About the same time, a new guy named Brian Michael Bendis launched Ultimate Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
That was a huge hit. That was an amazing twist on this new universe, still super grounded in what we already knew, but with able to go in new directions. So that's what first came to mind, sort of a rebirth of Spider-Man from two different takes, one absolute home run, the other your mileage will vary. John Byrne is a master and I'm not ever going to say he's not, but I think the storytelling, especially when juxtaposed by the new hotness of Bendis, it just wasn't there.
Yeah.
The Ultimate Spidey thing I very much enjoyed and read all the way up until I sort of faded out once I became a dad.
That is an awesome selection, because I had the same response when the Ultimate Universe was announced. I was like, I was there for New Universe in the 80s. I'm good.
You know, I still kind of like the New Universe.
I did too. Hey, I almost did a show on New Universe, actually. I considered it. I did. I actually really did. I'm the world's biggest Cyforce fan. I can tell you that. So yes.
I Cyforce as seen in, I got to put this in here because you mentioned Cyforce, mm-hmm. as seen in the movie Firewalker with Chuck Norris. There's a scene where the main bad guy is reading a comic and it says an issue of Cyforce.
Oh, that's awesome. That is awesome. Rest in peace, Chuck Norris. But anyway, when the Ultimate Universe was announced, I was pretty jaded on comics at that time and wasn't collecting a ton. And did, you know, I was like, I don't really know. I don't know these creators. I mean, I knew Mark Bagley, but I was like, I don't really know this Bendis guy. And then I was like, I'll give it a chance. And then like everybody else, you know, a few issues in, I was like, oh, this is the greatest thing. This is amazing. And I collected that book for over 100 issues. So that's a great, great choice. That's awesome. So that brings us to the end of the issue. Let's talk quickly about the art. Did you have a favorite page or panel in the book that you thought was especially well drawn or depicted?
Now, here is where peeking at the script did me a disservice. Because I did go out of my way to not look at your secret questions, but I did notice the panel you picked, which ironically enough was going to be the one that I picked.
Seriously? Okay. Yeah. If you had given me 1,000 panels for, and there's almost 1,000 panels in this damn book. If you had given me 1,000 panels, I never thought we would have picked the same one. So you go ahead. You take those two and tell the listeners about them.
Absolutely. If you haven't changed it, and if my memory serves, they should be from page 6.
Yep.
And I should preface this by saying that as of late, over the last couple months in my art career, one of the sort of gimmicky things that I've been doing, because, you know, artists are always looking for a gimmick, is I've been doing panel recreations.
Nice.
When I read something, because I have a good friend of mine, Greg Murray, and he does cover recreations, and he's the best cover recreation guy in the business. I'm just going to say that. You got a cover you love, Greg's the man. He'll recreate it for you. It'll look awesome. And I was like, I like what Greg does, but I don't want to copycat Greg, right? But I was like, what if I was to spend a little time, more time with just a panel that I think is really striking? And so I've been kind of, when I've been reading for podcasts and stuff, I'm just kind of on the lookout. I thought, oh, wonder if there's going to be a Wonder Woman panel that I might want to recreate, right? And unfortunately, this doesn't have the mass appeal because it's not Wonder Woman. It's two characters that no one even knows.
That we'll never see again. Yeah.
You'll never see them again.
Ever again. Yeah.
So... I know it's a long walk to say this, but I wanted you and your listeners to understand that I'm very keyed in to panels in particular these days, because I've been recreating them and selling them to pay my bills. Mm-hmm. But anyways, let's get to it. It's page 6. It's the bottom row of panels. It's the middle two panels of the bottom row. It's these two people who are spying. It's a young man and young woman. And they're spying. I can't remember who they're spying on, to be honest with you.
Well, they're spying on Cersei's like animal men.
Okay. And yeah. And they're very aware that Cersei can see through the eyes of animals and things like that. And they're very aware of this. So they're being very cloak and dagger. And they're pretending to make out on a bench. And what I really loved about the panel, and forced to pick one, I was going to take that first one. I really like that first one where it focuses on her, on mm-hmm. the female. Because he draws it so perfectly that you can tell that these are two people who are watching something, who are pretending to make out. Like just imagine, I know that not everybody here is an artist, and I'm no George Perez for sure. But if someone came to me and was like, draw a panel with two people who are pretending to make out, but they're really spying on someone, I'm like, what?
Yeah.
How the hell do you convey that?
And make both things believable. Yeah.
Yes. And George delivers.
Yeah. Yeah.
You don't need the word bubbles. Like mm-mm. you can look at that and go, oh, there's a spy thing. And then again, if you couple them, and I think it has a lot to do with how he's picked her looking out of the side of her eye on both of them, but yet still cupping the back of his head like a lover would do. Like it's every little detail in this very limited visual information is perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, I feel really vindicated because I thought it was a weird choice on my part when I zeroed in. Yeah, no, I did. I thought it was a weird choice on my part when I zeroed in on those because there are so many, you know, there's her flying through a fire, Diana flying through fire. There's the animal men turning, you know, from men into monsters. There's all these more sort of grandiose moments. But for me, the thing that makes Perez my favorite artist of all time is his storytelling. Is his emoting. He's one of those comic book creators where you could pull the words out of his books, flip through them, and pretty much get most of what's happening in the emotional tone of it. And those two characters, again, throwaway characters we're never going to see again, but they both look like they're, you know, she's afraid for her life. She's spying and she's being brave. But at the same time, they're clearly two people who do have a romantic connection. Like that is a familiar kiss. That's a familiar caress. And so, yeah, it's just, I mean, it's unbelievably good. He's just a master.
They're either lovers or they're like, they've been a spy duo for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. There's familiarity there though. It's definitely, I mean, they're just amazing. So yeah, I mean, I thought I was strange too, but I'm glad we both picked the same panels. So it's super funny that we chose the exact same oddball panel. That actually makes me feel good because it's so interesting and different. But before we cut bait from the issue, Jared, I asked you quite a few questions. Did you have any secret questions for me?
I did. I brought two secret questions because you said I had to. And interesting that you told your story about Greece and Italy at the beginning, because again, I just kind of tried not to read too much on the script because I knew there was secret stuff in there on the outline that you provided. But here's the question I asked, kind of oblivious to that. I just said, how many different countries have you been to?
Ooh. Okay, so that is a good question. Do you mind answering first so I can give you a chance to tally
up? Not a problem. Okay. No, I feel a little bad because, I mean, having been the son of a military man and then served in the military myself, my number's pretty high, and I don't want to be like, oh, I'm the coolest guy ever. But I did want to bring it up because I knew, you know, Wonder Woman is very international, and I did see enough to know that you had a story about Greece in there, and I was like, oh, well, I wonder how many countries he's been to. I've been to, I think at last count, like 32.
Oh my god.
Because I mean, I lived in Europe,
yeah,
and then I served in the Middle East, and then I've spent a lot of time just vacation and recreationally in the Caribbean. My wife's a Spanish professor, so she's done travel abroad to Central American countries, and then often I'll go with her. So I've had a ton of opportunities. Strangely enough, I've never been to Canada, which
actually
share a border with. I've been to I can't remember what's the name of the city. I'm not even going to try to remember. Upstate New York, where like you can literally see it from there.
Up
in that area. Yeah. And I've been to,
or Niagara.
I've been up to the very northern tip of Washington State where my brother lives, and where you can literally see Canada, but I've never actually been to it.
That's so funny.
It's funny that I've hit 32 places, but not Canada. But it's not about me. It's about you. It's your secret question, man. So let me know how many you've been to, or maybe some of your favorites.
That's really funny. So I have to say, especially if your brother lives in Washington State, definitely go to Vancouver. So I lived in Seattle for a while, and we'd go to Vancouver, British Columbia, all the time. Vancouver is, I think, one of the three most beautiful cities on the planet. And the way I always describe it is it's like New York, but clean. It's like, if you know, it's, yeah, it really is. It's a clean, like pristine, polybagged version of New York. It's really lovely. So
I'm interested.
Yeah, it's awesome. So I have been to, I'm, you know, I think I've got the count right. I've been to 15 countries, which is pretty good. I mean, I'm cheating because I'm counting like Canada and Mexico, but I have been to.
Hey, they count, man.
Yeah, there are other countries. You know, in chaperoning, I've been all over Europe. So I've been all over, you know, the Mediterranean. I've been to England, France, Spain, you know, Italy, Greece. Last summer, I went to Japan and South Korea. Nice. And yeah, that was amazing.
That's another area I have not been to.
Japan was mind-blowingly amazing. I've been to Russia, Finland, Sweden, Estonia, Turkey. Israel.
I like how you've been to all the places I haven't been. Like between the two of us, we've got the globe.
That's really funny. Yeah, yeah. I've been to Israel. I've been, you know, some pretty interesting places. So you asked my favorite. So I have what I call win the lottery cities. If I won the lottery tomorrow, I would buy an apartment on the Ramblas in Barcelona, Spain. The Ramblas is a square mile downtown Barcelona where there's no cars. They shut down. You cannot drive in the Ramblas. So it's all like stores and food stands and bars and just right by the water. And Barcelona, for people who don't know, is basically the Las Vegas of Europe, but with more culture. And it is amazing. So I would live in Barcelona, Vancouver, again, one of my favorite cities. And then, The most beautiful place I've ever been is Capri in Italy. It's one of the Italian Isles. It's right by it's by the Greek Isles. It's right by Santorini. And that is it's literally on the top of a cliff. It's a city on top of a cliff. It's what you picture when you picture the Greek and Italian Isles. Everything's white and blue and pristine and beautiful and, you know, crystal clear water. And that is another place. I was there with students in the early 2000s. I was chaperoning a trip, and you have to take a funicula up to get up to the top of the cliff. And as we're going up the cliff, I'm waiting, I'm doing student counts. And our tour guide runs off, chats with somebody and runs back. And he goes, okay, don't be weird. Don't be American about it, but Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie are in Capri right now, and you may see them as you're walking around, which, of course, set my kids off on the weirdest, treasure hunt of all time to try to see if they could find them. They never did, thankfully, because they would have been very weird and very American, but that's the most beautiful place. What about you? What's your favorite place?
I guess if I won the lottery tomorrow, I am very, very fond of Salzburg, Austria. Oh. I just love it there. It's been a long time since I've been there, but I'm very, very fond of Salzburg. I grew up in a little town in Germany called Fulda, mm-hmm. and I would not hurt my feelings to live in Fulda till the day I die. So,
Nice.
There's so many places, but those are the ones that immediately jumped to mind.
Yeah, that's awesome. Good secret question. You got another one?
I thought we'd have a good chat on that. Yeah. And my other one goes back to the Wonder Woman TV show where we started this conversation. Kind of. So what you might want to need to do is pull up an internet browser in the background, because my question to you is, Batman hits in 1989, right? And it sort of revitalizes the comic book movie industry, right? Mm-hmm. After that, you get Dick Tracy and Ninja Turtles and blah, blah. You know, you were there. What happens if, let's say, circa 1989, Batman hits and they immediately go, we're going to drop a Wonder Woman movie right after it?
Oh.
Now you got to cast Wonder Woman and you can't use Linda Carter.
Oh, that is.
So go ahead and pull up that browser tab and type in beautiful women of the 80s and tell me who you're going to take.
Yeah, 1989, a beautiful actress. So, I mean, look, I definitely, she doesn't have the hair, but I mean, Kim Basinger, you know, obviously is going to be somebody mm-hmm. who jumps out. Okay. Actually, you know what? I do think I found my person. I don't find her. I mean, she's gorgeous. I don't find her as beautiful as, say, Linda Carter, you know, or, mm-hmm. or even Gal Gadot, but the person I think could have brought real quirk to the role is Geena Davis.
She's on. I have two that I was going to mention. She's one of the two.
I think she would have brought real kind of a depth to that character. So yeah, I'd go Geena Davis. What about you?
And then you know why too? I think is because she's held her own in her own action movie.
Exactly.
Kiss Goodnight, Cutthroat uh-huh. Island. Like casting Wonder Woman is so tough because you have to be sexy and you have to be believable as a warrior at the same time, which is a tough cross. Roads to make. I mean, it is. I absolutely had Geena Davis as one of my two.
That's awesome. That's hilarious.
And my other one is a lesser known actress named Celia Ward, or is it Celia?
Oh, Celia. Yeah, so she was on Celia. Sisters, and yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I've seen her in a few things here and there, and I've always thought that she could pull that off as well.
That's a good choice too. Yeah, is it because Sigourney Weaver probably another one who could do it? And I mean, that's a great question.
It is. I'm patting myself on the back, but I think it is because it is such a hard role to cast. Yeah, like I said, you have to be. It's like casting James Bond. You have to be believable as a gentleman spy that could woo a woman, mm-hmm. and also believable as a guy who could slice someone's throat in a back alley and dump the body in a dumpster.
Yeah,
I'd be able to do both. And Roger Moore couldn't do both, but he could not do the second one.
Oh, God, no.
But he was really good at the first one.
Yeah, no.
Anyway, I'm sorry. We brought it back to Bond.
No, that's an awesome question. I think the only other person I'd probably say, and she may have been, maybe not though, a little too young, is Demi Moore. She would have been.
Yeah, no, yeah. She's done a few action things on her own,
yeah,
for certain.
And she's, you know, she's got that husky voice, you know, which, yeah, yeah. I mean, that's a great question.
I don't know if she has. I just had thought of another one too, because like when I think of female action stars that can really sell the action, of course I'm going to think of Linda Hamilton.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, I mean, that would have been right around like when they were doing Beauty and the Beast, that TV show. So
yeah,
that's a great question. Might
have pulled it off.
That's a great question. Oh my gosh. So that's a fun way to end talking about the issue, but we're not quite done with the episode yet, because each episode ends with a segment I like to call Bringing Peace to Man's World, where the guests and I take 30 to 60 seconds to identify one way the world we would bring peace to the world. This could be silly or serious or, you know, whatever the guests or I want it to be. Since I want the guest, I want you to have the last word, Jared. I'm going to go first. Mine's a little heavier than maybe I've done in the past, and I'm going to try to keep it a light version of it, but I just happen to be at an age, I think a lot of us are, where my parents, older, you know, aunts, uncles, older relatives are hitting the ages where their health is really taking a downturn, and it just seeing people suffer, you know, especially people you love, and not being able to help them, it just makes me, you know, it's heavy. It hits your heart and sits on your heart heavily, and it reminds me of, there's an episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation where David Ogden Stiers, who's Winchester from MASH, he's from a planet where everybody on the planet undergoes basically voluntary euthanasia. And this is not where I'm going, listeners. I'm just, stay with me for a minute. They undergo voluntary euthanasia at age 65. Now, this ends up being problematic in the episode because David Ogden Stiers' character is a scientist, and he's working on this really important project that needs him to be around for more years to see it through. Plus, he starts a relationship with Luxana Troi, Counselor Troi's mom. She's aghast by this idea that, you know, he would end his life when he has so much time to live. But it did at least put in my mind the idea of giving people more options or choices as they age. And I know, like, in parts of Canada, they have the ability for people to choose to, you know, peacefully, you know, end their own lives. And I just wonder, as a culture, never mandatory, only something voluntary, but I wonder if maybe if we reduced the stigma a little bit on it, if it might not ease the way for some folks who, you know, based on health or something else, might want to choose to have more control as they shuffle off this mortal coil. So a little heavy, but I just, you know, something I've thought about. And again, I don't actually have any decision either way. I just think, for the most part, people should watch that episode of Next Generation. It's really good. So Jared, what about you?
I'm familiar with the episode, by the way. It's one of the more memorable ones.
It really is. It's, and plus, you know, it's Winchester from MASH, which is awesome.
Right. AKA the Martian Manhunter.
Oh, good call.
Really, really know the deepest of all cuts. But but yeah, no, man, I feel you. I don't have a passionate feeling either way about your topic.
Uh-huh.
All I can tell you is a guy who, again, served in a combat zone in the Middle East. And I tell this to people. And I don't, let me preface it. I don't think of it as morbid as it's about to sound.
Mm-hmm.
There's a serious part of me, you know, to keep it less morbid, I'll call it the Lieutenant Dan part of me.
Okay.
That kind of wishes that I had died there.
Oh, wow.
Because now I'm going to die of something stupid. You see what I'm saying? It's like General Patton died in a car crash.
Oh my God, that's so,
like,
funny.
When you spend your time being your whole childhood wanting to be a military officer, and then you become one, and then you serve, and then you go to a combat zone. Like, it's hard. I think you get it. I think you get what
I do,
I'm saying.
No, I totally do. Like, yeah, I'm glad you.
It's like I survived all that, and now I'm going to die of something dumb. You know?
No, I totally do. You, yeah. So my version of this is when I was teaching, I read an article about a woman who went to a Mexican restaurant and didn't chew one of the tortilla chips hard enough, and it scratched her esophagus on the way down, and she died. She bled to death. And I literally went, oh, that's how I'm going to die. I'm going to die a tortilla chip death. That's my stupid death.
Yes. This is what's going to happen to me. And I'll be like, I was on the freaking battlefield. And then anyways.
That's really funny, Jared.
So that's my weird way of bringing levity to that discussion.
No, that was great. That was perfect.
So, let me put my glasses on, because I did prepare.
Very nice.
For my way to bring peace to the world. Now, having been a military man, I have a bold answer to how to bring peace to the world that I'm not going to put on the show because it's way too controversial. But anyways, I after my post-military career, I spent a good couple, 20 years? Yeah, 20 years thereabouts being a leadership instructor.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought I'd bring a mini lesson here.
Nice.
To help bring peace to maybe any listener. We do a show on Longbox Crusade Network. I know this is longer than 30 seconds, by the way.
Go ahead. You're good.
We do a show on Longbox Crusade Network called Pop Culture Posicast. And we take something out of pop culture that people generally don't like. Like we've done like Batman and Robin, the movie that no one likes. And we point out all the good things that are in it.
Uh-huh.
It's a fun little thing. And we end every episode with one of these little nuggets from my days as a leadership instructor that can help people, can help anybody. You don't have to be a leader, can help anybody in your daily life. And so when I saw that like bring peace to the world, I thought, well, maybe some of your listeners, even if just one or two of them go, I should think about that, could make their life better. So that's where I'm going with it. All right. So I'm going to give you the one called assigning motivations. We all do it and we all need to stop doing it.
Mm.
Okay. So what that means is a great example is you work in an office and someone goes around the office and goes, oh, you know, I'm heading to Subway today. You want a sandwich, place to order a sandwich, but they never ask you. And then they go get the sandwich. And then what are you going to do? You're going to assign a motivation to that. That's what we as humans do. Oh, that person left me out on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Which you're going to climb what we call the ladder of assumptions, mm-hmm. which means they hate me probably because that one time that thing I said, or because that one project we were on and blah, blah. You climb this ladder of assumptions. You go 6-7 rungs of this ladder of assumptions, by the way, of why they hate you, why they didn't take your sandwich order, what your past was with them, all that stuff. And you know what it is over 90% of the time? You just forgot.
Mm-hmm.
There's a huge lesson. That it sounds bad when I say it, but here I'm going to say it. People are rarely thinking about you.
Yeah.
Almost everything that you take as a personal slight is ignorance. Not that they're stupid. They're literally ignorant. They just don't know. Okay. Over 90% of things that we take as a personal slight, someone cuts you off in traffic. Look at this MF for blah, blah, blah. Cut me off. Who's he thinking? Like that dude didn't even know you were there.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't see you. 90% chance. It's not. We take things so personal. So there's a lot of freedom in realizing that people are not thinking about you hardly ever. Even the people in your life that you love the most, you know, your wife, your kids and all that. If you're honest with yourself, do you think about them every minute of every day? I know in a romantic sense, we want to say yes. And they are overall in our mind. But how often are you really thinking about them or anyone else? Like, Sean, I've known you. You were on like 5-6 years ago.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I've known you and I like you. How many times have I thought about you in 5 or 6 years?
Yeah.
Probably 4 or 5 times. Like when I see your stuff. Oh, that's Sean online. But, you know, and that's about it.
Uh-huh.
I'm not calculating any plans against you. I'm not plotting your death, you know, but we do that as people. We climb this ladder of assumptions. So this is an hour long lesson that I'm doing.
No, it's a good one.
This brief part of time, but I would challenge your listeners. If you want a more peaceful world, do your best to take a quick pause when you feel that anger, especially another person, and you start assigning, they did this because of that or this, or blah, blah, blah. Just dial that back for a second and go, wait, what's the simplest answer? Did they just forget?
Mm-hmm.
Cause you know what? That's probably it.
Yeah.
And so that's why awesome. Put yourself through that? Why strain your peace? Why attack someone else's peace when you could just pump the brakes and go, you know what? It's probably not thinking about me. It's just ignorance. So that's what I got for you, bud.
That's a great lesson. That was a great lesson to end on. That is a great lesson for people to take to heart. I you know, definitely is something that I've had to work on in my life. And, you know, I remember a teacher in high school when all of us were kind of starting to drive, he told a story about he and his friends were teenagers and this guy pulled out very suddenly, cut them off. They had to like swerve. It was dangerous and they were really angry. So they pulled up next to him and they rolled their window down. They're screaming at him and they're like ready to kill him. They're, you know, seeing red and they get to a stop sign and the guy goes, I'm so sorry. I just found out my wife is in labor. I'm trying to get to the hospital. And they all like mm-hmm. immediately, mm-hmm. you know, calm down and we're like, oh my God, you know? And so, yeah, I just, it's great. That's actually a great lesson to end on. I think Diana would approve. Well, Jared, Thank you so much for being on this episode. I always have fun when we get a chance to record together. This was a blast, as I knew it would be. Why don't you tell folks where they can find your work, your art, and your podcast?
All right, man, I appreciate it. If you want to hear me jibber jabber about more topics in the podcast world, check out Long Box Crusade or On Her Majesty's Secret Podcast. That's where we're doing our stuff. If you're interested in my art, you can check out www.theyardsaleartist.com, or I am at Yard Sale Artist on X, Facebook, and Instagram.
And I have to say, not only are your guys' podcasts amazing, and I love following your art, especially because you were doing, you know, the characters on pages of books. Now you're doing panels.
Still doing the books thing, but because that's my bread and butter.
Yeah. No, I love it, actually. I think it's really cool, and I love seeing the range of characters that you've got. But one of my favorite things, and this, I'm going to encourage people who maybe don't already, one of my favorite things about following you on social media are your yard sale finds or your Goodwill finds. Like, you'll post and you'll be like, you know, Goodwill find of the day.
Yeah.
And there is always something in there that makes me smile and go, oh my God, that's so awesome. I haven't seen that in like 20 years or 40 years, or I would totally play that game right now, or I would totally, you know, so that's awesome. That's great.
I'm so glad you dig that, because, like, honestly, you know, I do the art thing, and that to me is like advertising. Mm-hmm. You know, well, I need money. Here, look at this thing I drew. The joy of my social media, especially on X, I'm most active on X. I mean, if you message me on any other, I'm going to find you. But, like, especially on X, my joy is the exactly that. It's the yard sale finds. It's the Goodwill finds, the library finds. I just love, and I love it when other people do that too. So I'm glad that you picked up on the positive vibe.
No, I love it. It really does make me smile. It makes me so happy. It's so funny. And also, I'll be honest with you, makes me swing by my local Goodwills and be like, hey, I wonder what treasures there are.
Today could be the day. That's the whole thing. People always go to me, oh, you always find cool stuff. I don't ever find anything. And I go, well, I go by my Goodwill twice a week.
Yeah.
You know, you got to go a lot.
Yeah, you're like, there are plenty of days where I'm like, lampshade, no. You know, one sock, no.
Exactly, yes.
That's awesome. Well, thank you again so much for being on the episode. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
Now, listeners, we're going to divert a bit from our normal paradigm. Usually I would play a podcast promo break and then come back with feedback from the last episode. We're going to do the podcast promo break. That's going to end this episode. I will return with feedback from this issue and from next issue on the next episode. My apologies, not to get too heavy. I had a couple of very sudden passings in my family and had to travel to other states to sit Shiva. If you're unfamiliar, that's the Jewish process of mourning. It's about a week each, and so my schedule was unexpectedly delayed, and I will return next week with your feedback. I encourage you to please leave feedback at fireandwaterpodcast.com. Thank you again for listening. Thanks for your patience, for understanding. Thanks to Jared Albrick for being an amazing guest on this episode, and join me next month when we bring a little more peace to man's world.
Hey, listen to Longbox Crusade.